This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and the distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Thank you very much. And tonight I have the high privilege and distinct honor of my own as the first president to begin the State of the Union message with these words, Madam Speaker.
That moment from 2007 is one for the history books. But it took Nancy Pelosi 20 years to rise to the speakership after first being elected as a House Democrat to represent what was then California's 5th District. As powerful as she is polarizing, few other politicians have been as consequential. And that's what drew my next guest to interview more than 150 people, including 10 interviews with Pelosi herself, for the new book, Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. Susan Page is the author of this new biography. She's also the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Susan, welcome back to 1A.
Jen, it's great to be with you.
So a lot has been written about Nancy Pelosi being the first female speaker, but how did you balance that achievement against the ones that made her the first female speaker in the first place?
You know, I think that's such a great question, because if you ask most Americans, who is Nancy Pelosi, why is she notable? They would say she's the first woman to be speaker. She is the highest ranking, the most powerful woman in the American government since our founding. But she is also one of the most consequential speakers of either gender in modern times, one of the most effective legislative leaders in American history. And that puts her in the history books, too, for everything from passage of the Affordable Care Act, the biggest expansion of health care since Medicare and Medicaid, to the passage of that unpopular bank bailout in 2008 that cost Democrats politically in the next midterm election, but economists say helped us avoid a Great Depression.
You start with the fact that she was born into political royalty and family. Her mom and dad, you call Big Nancy and Tommy the Elder. And while her father was the one who held elected office, Pelosi's mother was an influential political operative in her own right. What lessons do you think she learned from watching her parents and the way they each wielded power?
You know, the D'Alessandros in Baltimore were like the Kennedys in Boston. They were the most prominent local political family. Her father was 3-term mayor of Baltimore, larger than life. But her mother, who got less attention, also incredibly formidable. She was, Big Nancy D'Alessandro was smart and ambitious and restless. She was a big risk taker. She loved playing the ponies at Pimlico. Sometimes she got in debt to the bookies who hung out at Sabatino's restaurant, which you can still go to in Little Italy in Baltimore. And she trained her daughter in the organizational skills, the political skills, the behind-the-scenes skills that has served Nancy Pelosi so well as a politician herself. Her mother kept what was called the favor file, which is exactly what it sounds like. It was a record of people, constituents who would line up and need favors to get housing or to get a kid out of jail or to deal with an immigration issue. And Big Nancy would write it down. She would try to take care of their problem. She would come back to them when she needed their vote or their support and expect to get it. That is almost precisely what Nancy Pelosi does today in closed doors in the Capitol.
Now, it's interesting because Pelosi could have easily followed in the footsteps of her mother rather than seeking office. And for a time, she was sort of that political operative working behind the scenes to get other people elected. Explain how she ended up in the House.
You know, it's a story that is really familiar to a lot of female politicians of her generation. They didn't think of themselves as candidates. They thought somebody else would be more qualified, probably some man. It took the encouragement of another woman to get them to run, to see themselves as a candidate. And in Nancy Pelosi's case, it was Sala Burton, who was a member of Congress from California. She was elected to the House herself after her husband, Phil Burton, legendary leader of a political machine in Northern California, had died. Now, Sala Burton, in 1987, had cancer, was dying herself, calls in Nancy Pelosi to her hospital room and says, Nancy, I would like you to run for this office, and if you do, I'll endorse you. And it was that gesture that prompted Pelosi to consider herself a candidate to run for that office. It was a wild, one of those wild San Francisco elections, 14 candidates in the primary. She prevailed, and she has never lost an election since.
Well, moving to the frame of your book, Lessons of Power, what do you think she learned as she entered that first role? And this was at the height of the AIDS crisis, and so she had some specific charges when she came into the House. Talk about that.
You know, there was a crisis in San Francisco then, which was the HIV/AIDS epidemic, which was raging through San Francisco, but still an issue of great controversy across the country. Most politicians in America refuse to discuss the issue of AIDS. That includes the president of the United States. It was very late in his presidency before Ronald Reagan acknowledged there was this public health crisis. Some Republicans, some conservatives, some evangelicals saw it as a moral crisis, not as a health crisis, not from San Francisco. Nancy Pelosi arrives on the floor of Congress, is sworn in to take office, is asked if she wants to make brief remarks, and she says that she is there to deal with the issue of AIDS. There were people, other members of Congress from California, who thought that was a mistake, that why would you identify yourself with an issue of such controversy? But it was the biggest issue in her district, and it's one that she dealt with. And by the way, she made a friend, an ally in the fight against AIDS. His name was Tony Fauci, someone who, of course, she has been dealing with for the past year and a half with this current epidemic of the coronavirus.
Well, for this book, you spoke to former President Barack Obama about the role Pelosi played in helping pass his signature legislative act. It was 2010, the fight over the Affordable Care Act, and here is Nancy Pelosi making her final argument to the House.
This legislation will lead to healthier lives. Again, Social Security, Medicare, health care for all Americans. I urge my colleagues and join together in passing health insurance reform, making history, making progress, and restoring the American dream. I urge and I vote. Thank you all very much.
When it comes to writing a comprehensive history of the ACA, where does she rank among the key players who got it over the finish line?
Well, you know, the Affordable Care Act would not have passed without President Obama. He set it as his a leading goal, a top priority for his administration. He staked his administration on it. But it also would not have passed without Nancy Pelosi. And there was a moment when people in the White House thought it could not get through Congress and they should do something smaller, maybe a bill that would just cover children. One of the people espousing that view was the White House Chief of Staff, one Rahm Emanuel, a familiar figure now, former mayor of Chicago, rumored to be about to be named ambassador to Japan. Rahm Emanuel was arguing to the president, to President Obama, that this was unrealistic. It was going to cost him politically, and it could not get through the Congress. And Nancy Pelosi came in for an extraordinary Oval Office meeting that has not been previously reported in full. She came in and she said to Obama, basically, you can go big or you can go home. That she would push through. She told him she would push through the big comprehensive version of the Affordable Care Act, or she would leave him to his own devices. And that meant that the smaller bill, the children-only bill, would not get through the House without Nancy Pelosi pushing it through. Now, maybe Obama would have gone big in any case, but that left him with essentially no choice. He went big. She pushed it through in a demonstration of the kind of political muscle that you rarely see, the kind of political muscle that gets the biggest and most controversial bills through Congress.
We'll be back with more from you and our guest in a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Amazon Prime Video with The Underground Railroad. From Academy Award winner Barry Jenkins and based on the Pulitzer Prize winning novel by Colson Whitehead, the new Amazon original, The Underground Railroad, chronicles Cora Randall, played by newcomer Tuso Mbedu. When she discovers an actual network of trains and tunnels beneath the southern soil, Cora must evade a violent bounty hunter before she can find freedom. The Underground Railroad premieres May 14th on Amazon Prime Video.
Today, it seems like everybody's got a bone to pick with the news. So it happens when somebody stops talking smack and just decides to wage all-out war.
First thing you do in an invasion, you eliminate the communications of the enemy.
And what happens if they win? visit Stockton, California, for a story about a revolt against the mainstream media that's shaken up a city. From NPR's Invisibilia.
Let's jump back into the conversation about Nancy Pelosi with Susan Page. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today and the author of the new book, Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. I'm curious, Susan, what was she like to interview? She chooses her words very carefully. How much was she willing to open up?
So, Jen, she's a terrible interview. She's a really tough interview. I don't know. Have you ever interviewed Nancy Pelosi?
I haven't. So I'm very intrigued.
I can tell you, you know, I'd interviewed her a couple times over the years before I worked on the book. She's just too guarded. She's very disciplined. It's the opposite of what you want. You want somebody who'll spill their guts when you ask them a question, somebody who'll start to cry when you press them. That is not Nancy Pelosi. But I can say after the 10 interviews I had with her for the book, she did open up more. She became more candid. I'm very grateful that she agreed to those interviews. And let me just say that I started the book with no understanding with her about whether she would talk to me. I had signed the contract to write this book without telling her that I was signing a contract to do a biography of her, which may have been stupid, but my reasoning was, if I told her and she said no, maybe I'd chicken out. Mm. And if I told her and she said yes, maybe she would think she had some sway over what I wrote. And I didn't want to do an authorized biography. I wanted to do a work of journalism. So I signed the contract and I go to her office and say, you know, I've signed this contract and I hope she'll talk to me. And they agree to an interview. It's still not clear how many interviews she's going to do. I go into her office, this spectacular office on the second floor of the Capitol with the best view in Washington of the National Mall, and she offers me a Dove bar. This is a very good sign because Nancy Pelosi loves chocolate. So I take the Dove bar, and she has a Dove bar of her own, and I bite into it, and I send little shards of chocolate icing all over her pristine carpet. All over her off-white carpet, little shards of chocolate. And I think, oh my, she's never going to invite me back. Here I'm trying to make a good impression, and I'm frantically picking up melting pieces of chocolate out of her carpet. And she did give me a look that I can only describe as a mother's look to what I was doing. She did invite me back. She did allow me to interview her 9 more times. But, Jen, I can tell you, she never again offered me any food.
It was a one-time offer, Susan. One-time offer.
Apparently.
when you're doing this type of work and you're trying to get a sense of a person's strengths and weaknesses, frankly, how do you go about teasing that out?
Well, you know, one of the great things about profiling politicians is that a lot of the stuff they do is in public. And they do it with people who are many times eager to talk positively about the politician or negatively about the politician. Here's one of the best descriptions of Nancy Pelosi, which was from someone who had observed her when he was a young Democratic operative in San Francisco, and she was just getting into politics. He said, "She's terrible at the things you can see, and she's fantastic at the things you can't see," which is to say, she's not a great orator. She doesn't give an inspirational speech. She's not good at the kind of impromptu back and forth with reporters. She's not terrific on the Sunday morning TV interview shows. Those are the things we can see. But the things we can't see when she's in behind closed doors negotiating a deal, or when she's meeting individually with members of Congress to persuade them to vote the way she wants them to vote, she is as good as anybody in American history.
Were you able to get to what's at the heart of that political muscle? What drives her?
She would say she's driven by the social justice causes that were inculcated in her by her upbringing. She was born into a devout Catholic family. She attended a girls-only Catholic school, the Institute of Notre Dame in Baltimore. Then she went to an all-girls Catholic college, Trinity College, now Trinity University here in Washington, D.C. She would say that she's driven by that attitude of a big role for government, a New Deal kind of role for government in providing a safety net for people, and especially people in need. And so she's always been, you know, she gets characterized as a San Francisco liberal. She's definitely a liberal. There's no question about that. I think what the caricature gets wrong, though, is she's also a Baltimore Paul. She's also a very pragmatic politician, and that has just recently put her at odds with some of the most progressive members of her party, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other members of the squad.
Now, Susan, you make it clear that Nancy Pelosi was getting ready to step away from politics in 2016. What happened?
Yeah, Jen, this was a little bit of a surprise. It turns out that she had been privately making plans to retire after the 2016 election was over on the assumption that Hillary Clinton would be elected to the White House, would protect Democratic priorities like the Affordable Care Act, and she, at the age of 76, could step down. Well, election night comes. She's as surprised as many of the rest of us when Donald Trump wins the White House. By the end of election night, she decides she's going to stick around to stand up to this unexpected new president. But, you know, David is making a point that a lot of Democrats have, including Democrats who are part of the Democratic caucus, including those who think Nancy Pelosi has done a phenomenal job in her role as leader, that it's time for a new generation to take over. Nancy Pelosi is now 81 years old. The top three leaders of the Democratic Party in the House are all in their 80s. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a general feeling that it's time for new leaders to come up. Nancy Pelosi has not made the sort of Sherman-esque statement that this is her last term, but I think that I expect this is her last term. I think this probably is her valedictory term, that she'll step down and that there will be a new generation of leaders elected after the next midterm. Now, whether they'll be electing a Speaker of the House or a House Minority Leader, we don't know. But I do think a new generation of leaders is poised to take over.
Up next, we'll talk about what proved to be a consequential fight with our former president.
You know, Nancy's in a situation where it's not easy for her to talk right now. And I understand that. And I fully understand that. We're going to have a good discussion and we're going to see what happens. But we have to have border security.
Mr. President, please don't characterize the strength that I bring to this meeting as the leader of the House Democrats who just won a big victory.
Elections have consequences, Mr. President.
Let me just say.
We'll be back with more in just a moment.
This message is sponsored by Norton, publisher of The Premonition by Michael Lewis. In 2019, a panel of public health experts judged the United States to be more prepared than other nations for a pandemic. Where did we go wrong? New from the best-selling author of The Big Short, Moneyball, and The Fifth Risk comes a taut and brilliant nonfiction thriller that pits a band of medical visionaries against a wall of ignorance. The Premonition, a pandemic story by Michael Lewis. Wherever books are sold, from W.W. Norton.
Hi, it's Jen White. From politics to pop culture, 1A is the place for the national conversation on NPR. And our upgraded 1A Vox Pop app is the fastest and easiest way to add your voice. You'll see the latest and get a jump on upcoming stories all at the press of a button. Download the new 1A Vox Pop app for iOS and Android today and make yourself heard loud and clear on 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
Let's jump back into the conversation by talking about Pelosi's relationship with former President Trump. Now, in your book, there's this now iconic photo from October 2019. It's a White House meeting, and you see Pelosi standing up and pointing her finger at then President Trump. To what extent will that relationship define her political legacy?
Well, I don't think it's consequential. It's important. She would say her biggest legacy is the Affordable Care Act, but certainly her ability to stand up to Trump for 2 years when Democrats were in a very weak position. Remember, Republicans controlled not just the White House, but also the House and Senate for 2 years. She was playing a weak hand to prevent things that she thought were bad from happening. And then for 2 years, playing a strong hand after Democrats gained control of the House. This is an important part of her legacy, that she held Democrats together, that she was reluctant to pursue impeachment, but then pursued impeachment not once, but twice against Trump. And then finally, this extraordinary scene on January 6th, when the mob stormed the Capitol, refusing to accept the results of the election. That was just remarkable. And I talked to her a couple weeks ago about what she thought about January 6th, something she has not really talked about in a public way. I asked if she thought the mob would have killed her if they had caught her. And she said, yes, that was what they had set out to do. And then she said, now remember, this is an 81-year-old mother, grandmother of nine. She said, but they would have had a battle on their hands because I'm a street fighter. And then she lifts up her foot. We're sitting in the speaker's office. She lifts up her foot high enough so I can see it over the flower centerpiece on the coffee table and says, points to her 4-inch stilettos and says, besides, I could have used these as weapons.
What was your reaction? I'm sure in the moment you probably tried to hold back a reaction, but that's quite a statement, Susan.
It's so fierce. Well, actually, I laughed because, of course, the mob didn't catch up with her, although not by much did they miss her. The mob didn't catch up with her, so I laughed, and she laughed too, but she is pretty fierce, and she is quite fearless. And I went through a couple titles in the process of writing this book, but one thing all the titles had in them was the word power, because she is so comfortable with amassing and wielding power. And that reflects, I think, a lesson she learned from her father, which is this: no one is going to give you power. You have to take it. And that is a lesson she's followed in her own political career, and it's advice that she has given to generations of people with political hopes.
We should talk about her relationship with those lawmakers, as you mentioned, who've become known as the Squad, a progressive collective who've been critical of her and the party. And here's one exchange from a recent interview Pelosi gave to 60 Minutes and a reaction to this question from reporter Leslie Stahl.
Why does AOC complain that you have not been grooming younger people for leadership?
I don't know. You'll have to ask her. Because we are.
That was kind of sharp, kind of dismissing her.
I'm not dismissing her. I respect her. I think she's very effective, as are many other members in our caucus that the press doesn't pay attention to. But they are there, and they are building support for what comes next.
How sensitive is Pelosi about the criticism that she hasn't done enough to bring in people who are younger to groom these next leaders?
Well, she has held on to power for a long time, the longest hold on power since Sam Rayburn, the legendary House Speaker that none of us are old enough to have actually covered. She has a really complicated relationship, I think, with AOC. She told me that she sees some of herself in AOC, her willingness to be disruptive, to challenge the established order and the established powers. That was something Nancy Pelosi certainly did when she ran for the leadership in the first place. On the other hand, her criticism is that they are not realistic about how you actually get things done, as opposed to talk about them. And in one of the interviews I had with her happened to fall on the day of just a huge explosion between the Squad and the rest of the Democratic caucus in a closed-door meeting. My interview was briefly after that, the same afternoon. She came into this interview still all wound up. And I asked her I used a phrase that she has used about, did the Squad understand the difference between making a beautiful pâté and making sausage? And Pelosi's line has been, we'd like to make a beautiful pâté, but most of the time we're making sausage. That is something that is not quite so fine and is quite a bit more messy. And I asked if they didn't understand that. And that really got a reaction from her, one of the most spontaneous reactions of any of the interviews I did. She said that some people come to Washington to pose for holy pictures to show how pure they are, and that other people come to Washington to get things done. And it is clear that even though Pelosi is a devout Catholic, Posing for holy pictures is not praise in her book.
I wonder if that, though, is part of the critique, is that there is a new group of politicians, a squad, who says, you know, the way we've done things in the past, it doesn't work. You know, the status quo of just making the sausage, why aren't we trying to make the pâté?
So fair point, and we're going to have a test of that debate, I think. Assuming she does step down at the end of this term, I think there'll be not only multiple candidates to succeed her, there'll be candidates from different parts of the party. I think there'll probably be a candidate or candidates from the most progressive wing who would argue, let's have higher aspirations, let's be tougher, let's refuse to take half a loaf, let's go for a whole loaf. And there'll also be contenders who have a more traditional view about the need to make compromises to get things done. That will be a question facing Democrats just next year.
Well, Carl asks, who can replace her? Who and how will the next speaker hold Congress together? Did she have any reflections on who these next leaders might be?
So I think that, you know, I think that when she chose that first group of impeachment managers, she was signaling the people who she saw as leaders of the next generation in the House. You know, she put Adam Schiff, the congressman from California, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, someone who's very close to her, she put him in charge. Behind the scenes, she would call him the general. She also put Hakeem Jeffries on that team. Hakeem Jeffries, congressman from New York, a member of the leadership now. If he succeeded Nancy Pelosi, he would be a groundbreaker as well. He would be the first person of color to lead a party in either house of Congress. Val Demings was someone who was a new member of Congress, not well known. She put her on that team. That really raised Val Demings' profile, the congresswoman from Florida. It helped put her on the short list for Joe Biden's running mate. Now she's looking at running statewide in Florida. One more, Jason Crow, also a new member of Congress, someone who voted against her for Speaker, but with whom she now has a good relationship, and she put him in that prime spot. Those are some of the names I think that she sees as the rising leaders in the Democratic House.
That's Susan Page. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Her new book is called Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and the Lessons of Power. Susan, it's great to talk to you. Today's producer was Rupert Allman. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.